Never fear about that. This is Mae Warren. Today is the 2nd of May, 1997. I'm in Lexington, Virginia, finally with Walter Blake. And I am just so pleased to finally be with you and to finally be meeting you.
Thank you.
It comes as no surprise to you, but the primary reason I want to talk to you is because you're one of the first two black students at Washington and Lee who graduated. Can you tell me how that came to happen in your life?
Yes, very easily. As you know, or probably may know, I am a native of Lexington. I actually grew up at 9 North Jefferson Street for the first 7 years of my life, and 9 North Jefferson is currently the parking lot between the Phi Kappa Sigma House and the University Cleaners. And literally my first conscious memories other than of parents and immediate family were of Washington and Lee students, especially Phi Kappa Sigma brothers who taught me to play Frisbee and do all those other kind of fun things that little kids like to do. And I remember looking up at the hill and thinking, God, that's really kind of a neat place. I like it. I was indoctrinated very early, you know, from not only the proximity, but the fact that my mother worked for William P. Coleman, a local attorney who was a Washington and Lee graduate. So it was kind of in the blood. And when I went through school locally, I did fairly well academically. And in 1967, I believe, the fall or whenever it is, you take the PSAT or whatever the test is that takes you on into that next level, mm-hmm. did quite well and became a semifinalist or whatever it was in the National Achievement Scholarship Program and was targeted or pinpointed or whatever you want to call it as a minority with talent at that time. Mm-hmm. So in 1968, my senior year, I was recruited by I lost count, but something along the order of a recruited, contacted combination of the two by something like 200 schools. And those schools ranged all the way from Harvard down to Grinnell College in Iowa. But by that time, I'd pretty much made my mind up that Washington and Lee was going to be it for me. I had it in my heart, and I had it in my heart for several reasons. One was that in 1966, I believe Dennis Haston, another product of the Lexington school system, had come. And Dennis was a friend of mine, kind of a big brother to some extent. And it pretty much worked him over. He didn't last, as you know. And I was probably brash enough and confident enough in my ability to say one of two things. First off, I wanted to prove that a black student could come here and withstand whatever this institution threw at him and make it out. That was clearly a selfish motivation on my part at the time, but an even more selfish motivation on my part was the fact that I understood even then at the age of 16 that if I was serious about making a life professionally in the South, which I really wanted to stay in the South, defined as in my mind, anything from Maryland, the South. Washington and Lee was clearly the preeminent and premier institution for me to do that. Just because of the contacts, the education, you couldn't beat it.
How did you know that at 16?
I don't know. I really don't know, but I just had this feeling, and I recall, and this is one of the strange things that happened in my life. I got a letter my senior year from Harvard informing me that I had been accepted in the entering class of 1968 and that I was the recipient of some scholarship. I have no clue what the name of it is now, but it was a significant amount of money, and it was a significant piece of financial assistance. And I remember thinking to myself, man, these are some fairly arrogant rascals up there, you know, to presume that I'd want to go to Harvard. I mean, hey, you know, clearly Harvard's a nice school, but I don't particularly want to do it. So I jotted a nice little handwritten note on the bottom of their letter and sent it back to them and suggested to them that I wanted to attend Washington and Lee because I considered it to be the Harvard of the South, and I was a Southerner. I never heard from them again one way or the other, so I, you know, they probably put it in some round file and said, well, we'll give it to the next guy on the list, which clearly they had no problem doing. But I just knew it. I don't know. I think because if I had not been a native of Lexington and had not really come through that culture from the earliest days, I wouldn't have known that. But I had been so immersed in this institution and the students and faculty and administration, you know, the kids of some of the faculty members and I used to play together on the front campus over here, which is now a parking lot. We had a football coach, assistant coach, whatever name, McCann, and he had a son named Michael. And apparently, and I do remember this very plainly, but I was 6 years old and it was just before I started elementary school. Michael and I were playing. Michael was probably 4 years old and I was probably five, had just turned six. Michael darted out in front of a car on Jefferson Street, and they tell me that I pushed him out of the way and got nailed myself. Well, all I can recall is saying, hey, I'm going to try to make it across too. If he's going to make it, I can make it. I didn't go out consciously to push the little kid out of the way, but I did. So that kind of ingratiated me with a number of people on the Hill, and Henry Howard, I believe treasurer, his name was Howard, lived in the house right over on the street next to the church. His family, the McCanns, the Fishwicks, those were all families that I knew. I knew the kids, and I knew the institution through those people, and it just was ingrained in me. I always could perceive, even then, that this place was somehow special. And it used to be a ritual of mine every day, every year when I finished up school, I went to elementary school at Lilburn Downing. Every year, my treat was getting out of school on that last day and walking home, and the way I would walk home, rather than coming basically through the neighborhood, I'd come down Main Street, come up the little alley right over by in front of the Red Front grocery store by Professor Wise's house, and then walk down the colonnade. And usually it was a fine spring day right around Memorial Day. And then there was just something about those columns and that red brick and that grass lawn that just kind of jazzed me, for lack of a better word. And that's how the decision was made. I didn't seriously consider any other institution. I clearly had options galore, but consciously there was no consideration whatsoever that I would go anywhere else other than here. And I think I always knew that. Actually, I think I always knew that I was going to go to school here. I just was kind of like, okay, I'm going to do it. You know, and whether I was first, second, third, 15th, it made not really much difference. It just happened to be the luck of the draw that I happened to be the one who was one of the first to do it. And needless to say, it was interesting. It had its moments.
Well, let's talk about those moments.
Okay. Where do you want to begin? Because there are so many.
Well, you start.
Well,
obviously you have your moments. And
My moments started at freshman camp. I mean, my moments really started at freshman camp. We were going to Natural Bridge at freshman camp then, which was just an incredible experience. And in 1968, discounting the fact that Linwood and I came in 1968, the class that entered here in 1968 was probably one of the landmark classes in the history of the institution anyway, not so much because of the makeup of the class, but just because of the times. You know, we were a class that suffered large attrition because of Vietnam and the war, and, you know, guys trying to figure out ways to get out of the military, either getting drafted or transferring because of, you know, their threat of being drafted. We were the last class to have mandatory Saturday classes. We were the last class with dress code. We were the last class with the six-cut rule in effect. We probably were the last full class in which ROTC was mandatory for the first 2 years, I believe. So that time was really kind of a very interesting time in not only the life of the institution, but the life of the country in which the institution was located. And while the institution reflected very much those, you know, those nice traditional values and style that it had for so much of the 50s and early 60s, as I recalled it, it was beginning to change simply because the world around it had changed so radically. And my class entering was one that really kind of hastened that change. For instance, I'll use the Kappa Alpha House, which was considered, at the time I came along, the flower of white Southern manhood. Well, when we went through Rush, I went through Rush pretty much, you know, on my own, and I went to the Kappa Alpha House knowing, of course, their restrictions on ever being able to offer me membership. But that didn't stop me from going back on several visits, simply because we all got along real well. We liked each other. And it was kind of apparent that there was some rapport and camaraderie that had developed just because of force of personality or style or whatever you want to call it. And, you know, maybe I was different enough that, you know, these guys could perceive it. Let's talk to this guy. He's at least, you know, he's fun to be around. And that class, I'd say the class was the first to have what I'd call a serious hippie contingent. Because my class, while there were hippies in classes prior to mine, mine really was the class that defined hippiedom at Washington and Lee. The class of 1970, I think they took the credit for the demonstrations on campus. They may have been the leadership, but clearly the foot soldiers in that whole campaign were class of 72 members. The true foot soldiers were guys in my class. And they were an amalgamation of guys who were, you know, what one would be considered traditional Southern rockers, like the Allman Brothers fans, who had been formerly straight, short hair, you know, conservatively dressed KAs and SAEs to your traditional Northeastern Jewish liberals that were ZBT House members, and I was a ZBT. And so that class kind of defined a period in the university's history, and I had an interesting role in that class because I was one of only two black students in that class. And race relations in this country were at an interesting state. We'd come up with the riots. The Black Panther Party was a high-profile political cause and issue. And my major, which was an independent major, kind of concentrating in economics and engineering and all those things leading to a planning degree, allowed me the freedom to indulge myself in some activities that my very dear friend Linwood Smothers couldn't. He was an engineering major, and Linwood basically on his first day got his books and went over in a corner somewhere and started studying, which he had to do. Well, I had to study, of course, just to stay here, like everyone else. I mean, you didn't get 2.0s or whatever in order to be initiated by not doing anything. You did have to work a bit. But it was a bit easier taking my course of study than it was taking his course. Plus, my nature's a bit different than his. You know, I'm one that, you know, like, once again, force of personality. I don't mind jumping into something. And that evolved, you know, from just being a fairly gregarious person to one that began to take on senses or a sense of purpose and understanding a cause. And by doing that, got involved in a whole range of just interesting situations on this campus. Things like the spring of 1970 demonstrations and protests and.
What was your role in that?
I defined myself as one of those foot soldiers in the class of 72. Mm-hmm. Jeff Jingle clearly was the titular leader of that whole effort. There were a number of other people. But while Jingle was the identified leader, I was what I think he would define as a trusted lieutenant, or if not trusted lieutenant, a darn good private who would kind of go out and do what had to be done. And one of the things that I did along with one of my classmates is go to Washington, D.C. and recruit several members of the Black Panther Party to come to campus and make a speech. Yeah, speech was made in Lee Chapel to
a packed house.
One of the most amazing, surreal experiences I've ever in my natural life gone through. And I was telling someone last night, I still marvel at the fact that we went to Washington one afternoon, picked up several people, brought them back to campus, they spoke, and we turned around and took them back that same night. But it was an announced event. And as I recall, I forget the time that we had planned to do it, maybe 7 o'clock, something like that, I don't know, whatever it was. It was sometime after dinner. And we, of course, get to Washington and pick up our guests, visitors, passengers, whatever you want to call it. And we get delayed coming out of the city, trying to get out of Georgetown. Traffic is just humongous. The Key Bridge is backed up from here to there. You know, we're in way late, so we get on the telephone, we stop, call, and say, look, we're going to be probably an hour late or so. Thinking, well, you know, maybe that'll dampen the enthusiasm, but it didn't. We get to Lexington, and I forget exactly how late we were, but we walked into Lee Chapel, and Lee Chapel was basically packed to the gills. I'll never forget, we had people sitting in the balconies, and I'll never forget Lloyd Grubmeyer and Lloyd Wolf, Mark Grubmeyer and Lloyd Wolf were sitting in the balcony, kind of looking over the side, and you know, there was this rumble among the crowd when we walked in, because everyone was talking, and kind of like, you know. And we walked in, and they saw these people, and it was absolute silence. Just, it was like, and I'm thinking to myself, man, what have I, you know, this is unbelievable. Members of the Black Panther Party standing in front of the recumbent statue, talking. And it was, as I say, it was just surreal. It was a great reception, relatively speaking. I mean, it was a civil reception. I mean, there wasn't any, you know, provocative action that would cause one to get themselves hurt or anything. They listened, and there were some questions, and we left. And it was like, well, I'll be darned. But that was, I remember driving back up the road. I mean, just thinking to myself, what just happened there? You know, that was pretty weird when you think right about it. Yeah. Went back to Washington and came back, and that's when it really started getting
Now,
exciting.
Let me understand. Was this during the 8 days in May?
Yes.
The so-called 8 days?
Yes.
This happened?
This was
part of that.
It was either the 8 days in May or sometime in late April or whatever. It was that period right about the time that the institution closed down early.
Okay.
Because we closed probably 2-3 weeks ahead of schedule. I know we had talked about at the end of, this was my sophomore year. We had talked about, I think the standard graduation date would have been June 6th or something like that, 5th, 6th. School probably closed around May 6th, so maybe a month early. And it had started with all these things going on nationally. There was an announcement that we'd been doing secret bombings in Cambodia. Kent State happened. The Black Panther trials and the Chicago 7 trials were going on up in New Haven and Chicago and other places. And it was happening on campuses all over the country. I mean, there was this sense of just pure outrage. The draft was going on, and you know, the war had been a sore topic forever. I mean, since I came, I mean, even my freshman year, the war was a very sore topic, because 1968, the Tet Offensive, and we were getting our people killed right and left. I had lost a cousin just before coming here in the war, and you know, was fairly ambivalent to say the least, because I didn't see much rhyme or reason for it. It was getting crazier and crazier and crazier, and it was kind of like, well, this makes no sense to me, and it made no sense to any of my peers, of course, because we were the guys getting shot at. And sense of duty and loyalty, I think all of us had it, but it's like, look, if we're going to do this, let's understand the purpose. So, surprisingly, Washington and Lee really was one of the earlier schools in the country to have a what I'll call a consciousness raising on campus. I won't call it an uprising or whatever, student revolt. I'll call it a consciousness raising, because that's really what it was. There were people who I never in my wildest dream, never in my wildest dream would have imagined would have taken positions or participated in situations that did, that made statements, that listened, that in the traditional Washington Lee way engaged in what I'd call relatively rational thinking and debate and came up with some conclusions. And it was, at that point in time, it was so foreign as a concept to this institution that I really think the faculty and administration, primarily the administration, thought to themselves, I mean, you know, what is going on, and we have some significant potential here for some serious kinds of things to happen. People were taking off and going to Washington to the protests. We were having guys getting arrested and jailed at the stadium along with tens of thousands of other people. And the university made a decision to basically call it off early, because that was seen as a way, I believe, to basically put the lid on anything that may happen that could be considered insightful to a, you know, a more violent or physically challenging confrontation. And the university said, look, we'll do it rationally. We will call off classes. We will reschedule examinations. We'll once again back to our beloved honor system. We were able to work with individual professors with regard to the schedule for taking exams, finishing up whatever year you happen to be in. That happened to be my sophomore year, which pretty much was a wash for me as far as I was concerned. You know, freshman year you came in, you were terrified. Me particularly, because it's like now I consider to be the big leagues. I'm competing against guys who have advantages that I've only dreamed of, and how do I do it? No, I did it all right. I did pretty doggone well, in fact. And it became a situation where it was time to take leave. So we took leave in May of 1970. And in May of 1970, when I left, Linwood Smothers and I still were the only two black students on campus. When we came back in September, much to my joy and my surprise, we had 19 freshmen. And it was interesting because I had a conversation with Dean John or someone, and I have decent relationships with most of my professors, and just because we respected each other, and you know, politically we may not have agreed, and you know, typically just, you know, he's, you know, he's just kind of a wild 19-year-old or whatever, 18-year-old, whatever the guy is at the time. We agreed to disagree, but we always respected each other. And when the 19 guys came, I remember kind of picking out 7 people and immediately struck up a bond with these 7 guys. I mean, it was just like we had never met each other in our lives. But within 5 minutes, we were brothers. I mean, it's like, I know you. I don't know your name. I don't know where you're from, but I know you. And we became like this. The other 11 weren't quite that close to me, but that initial core of people, Thomas Penn, Philip Hutchison, Bob Ford, Bill Hill, Johnny Morrison, Matthew Towns, and Bobby Smith, that was kind of the core of what became SABU, Student Association for Black Unity. We had a meeting over in the co-op when these guys were freshmen, and there'd been a number of minor incidences on campus, mostly incidences that related to what I'd call items of insensitivity, things that people get bent out of shape about just because we got nothing better to do than get bent out of shape. You know, we're here in Lexington, we're isolated, we're away from the ones we love in most cases, and we got to go to a basketball game and listen to Dixie. Well, I had no problem with Dixie, and I knew what it was and didn't bother me one way or the other. But as it was being used by certain people, it became somewhat inflammatory. And there were some other comments that were made, some of the guys, and some actions were taken, sometimes not by students, but by members of the community. We decided we needed to adopt a model, and if that model were something along the lines of the Black Panther Party or whatever, we needed to do it because we needed to band together for what I'd really call self-preservation. And we did. We met over in the Student Union and created SABU, Student Association for Black Unity. I was the first president of SABU and a founding director, or whatever you want to call it. And SABU for a number of years became really the focal point for Black students on campus. It became a fairly effective organization, and then it went through its own internal struggle because there was a change in the nature of the student that came through here. And this institution, I'll maintain to this day, this institution, while it has blessed a number of us with the education that it gave us, I also think that a number of the ones who came through in that initial group enriched this institution because they came and they brought a very different perspective on the world, and it helped sensitize a lot of people. And I developed friendships 25 years ago, well, more than that, nearly 30 years ago with people in my class that have gone on till today. And these relationships have been with people that are as diametrically opposite of me as one could imagine. I mean, guys from Shreveport, Louisiana, whose fathers were corporate executives who, you know, of oil and gas companies. Kids from enormous family wealth. These guys have been lifelong compatriots, guys that I can speak with. And we've talked over the years, and they've all said things like, you guys helped sensitize us more than we sensitized or educated you. And one of the things we tried to get across was the fact that it's a big old world out there, and not all of us are different, and we all come from somewhat different frames of reference. And, you know, while I may not be exactly like you, in many respects I'm exactly like you. Because there is no way in my mind that one could come to this institution, and I have said this, and I will go to my grave saying this. This is a, like many institutions that have something unique about them, this place attracts a certain type of person. And either you are built to come here and succeed, or you're not. And you can't force fit the mold. It's like some people go into the military and do very well, and some people go in and wash out quickly. Guys who've come here, who've been what I call moderate performers, average performers, have gone on in life and done just some incredible, incredible kinds of things. There is something innately embedded in people who have come here and done well. And that trait has been as evident in the Black students who've come here and done well as it has been in the white students who've come here and done well in later life, or succeeded, or have survived. You had to be a survivor to make it through here. You absolutely had to be a survivor.
As a Black student?
As any kind of student.
As any kind of
student. As any kind of student, you had to be a survivor. You especially had to be a survivor to be a Black student. When I showed up here, if I weren't just purely, if I didn't have what I'd call a mean, ornery, contrary streak in me, I'd have been a dead puppy after about 2 weeks. Basically, it's an attitude that bothers my wife to this day. I can take anything and go home and go to bed and go to sleep. It's just like, so what? I'll deal with it. And you have, you know, once you developed that ability, and this place clearly honed that ability in me to a fine razor edge, it's something that has held me in good stead to this very day and will for the rest of my life. But if you didn't have that innate whatever it took, you didn't stay here. And if you looked at that 19 people that came in the fall of 1970, a number of the ones that were very highly rated according to the, what I like to laugh at, the standard statistical measure, mm-hmm. they washed out very quickly because they
were not of a mindset to put up with the kind of challenge that was put down before them. And there was, and there is a saying, I'd rather switch than fight. Well, our saying was, we'd rather fight than switch. You know, we are who we are, and we are going to fight to maintain it. And we can all coexist within the framework of this institution, and all of us understood that the one thing we could all get from here was just an incredible education and an incredible base of contacts. And you look at Johnny Morrison, you look at Bill Hill, you look at Matthew Towns, you look at all those guys who came here and survived out of that original group and have done well for themselves in later life. They all had that fundamental toughness, that survivability. And frankly, if they didn't have it, they would have been gone by the end of the first semester. And in one case, we had one guy who may have been gone before the end of September. I don't know how long he lasted, but it wasn't a tremendous amount of time.
Walter, you have gone 75 different directions I want to pursue.
Okay.
You are a wonderful interviewee. I'm tempted to go back in chronological order, but I want to stay where you are right now. I've interviewed Hill,
mm-hmm.
who tells me I can't call him Bill. I have to call him Hill.
Mm-hmm.
And he talked about what a difference you made to those guys, that you helped them see how to survive.
Mm-hmm.
Did you have this big brother relationship to them? Or it sounds like when they arrived, it was, what was that relationship? I mean, it sounds like you're describing something a little different than he described, but I may not understand.
It really is almost what one would call a big brother relationship, and Hill is, and I've talked about that a lot. But in some cases, I wasn't much older than they were. Philip Hutchison and I are 6 months apart in it. We're 6 months apart in age at most. So there was not a tremendous age difference, but experientially, I had 2 years on them. And as I said, there were, you know, six or seven guys out of that 19 or 18 or whatever that I, to this day, don't understand the connection that was made. I didn't even know their names, but we just looked at each other and we knew that, yeah, okay, you are a guy who can make it here. And I took it upon myself to hold hands, cajole, protect, do whatever I had to do to get those guys through. And if they considered me a big brother, then that's, that, you know, that's more power to them or me or whoever. But we were just close. We were absolutely, truly friends in the most fundamental sense. If one of us ate, all of us ate. If none of us ate, if one of us didn't eat, none of us ate. I mean, that's just the way it was. You did not do something to one of that group unless you did it to all of them. And it was pretty much known around campus that you really don't want to go mess with this one, because if you do, you have six or seven other people to deal with. So you just keep them happy, because we're not real sure which way they might go. But the relationship, I can't even begin to describe it at times, because sometimes it was almost we could finish each other's sentences. We were just so simpatico, I mean, in terms of our thinking and our habits and our styles and everything. And it was just something that we felt comfortable together. We felt protected, and it was like my extended family. They were my brothers. Not necessarily little brothers, they were just my brothers. And mm-hmm. I didn't particularly think of them as little brothers that I had to nurture and bring along. I just looked at them as my brothers.
Mm-hmm.
And whatever a brother would do for me or I'd do for a brother, that's the way I treated those guys. And I mean, that's just kind of the way it was. And there were guys in that class, in that same class, that I didn't have that relationship with. It was a much more formal type relationship. You know, we were friendly. We spoke, we talked, we joked around, but there was not that sense of, if it really comes down to it and I have to put it on the line for this guy, will I? Sense. But there was that core group that it was like, yeah, we'll
now,
do that.
Were those other guys in Sabu?
They were all in Sabu. Everyone was in Sabu. Every black student on campus kind of was in Sabu, whether they wanted to be or not. You know, really, going back to the old analogy of cream rising to the top, it's just the natural leadership and force of personality of that group. You can tell we had some strong personalities in that group. And managing the personalities was not really a chore, but it was something that had to be done, and I managed to get it done. But those were the guys who I think everybody else said will be in Sabu as well, simply because we know we feel protected. They weren't as blatant in their membership of Sabu as we were. We wore our Sabu jackets everywhere. Everybody may have been a member of Sabu, but you really knew who Sabu was. Sabu was, six, seven, eight guys, and that basically was it. Technically, Sabu was 21, 22 people, but the core group of Sabu, the Sabu 7 or 8 or whatever you want to call them, that's those guys.
Now, when you first talked about them coming in 1970, you said you were delighted and surprised. Did you really not know they were going to be more black students?
Well, I didn't really know it, simply because there was so much confusion going on in the spring of 1970 with regard to everything else going on that there was no real announcement that anything was going to happen. Mm-hmm. With the uncertainty that my sophomore year ended, you really didn't know what the institution was going to do come September or August or whenever we had to come back to school. Mm-hmm. So no one in the administration came to me and said, look, we've got some help coming, because I don't think they perceived it as that, but I did. It's like, yes, I got some help. Thank you. Up to that point, I had been a member of ZBT, and that was basically my campus family. I mean, my fraternity brothers were my campus family, and it was immediate when the guys showed up. It was like, yeah, finally. I mean, my ZBT brothers were very close to me, and still are very close to me, but there was still something that I'm able to share with that six or seven guys of Sabu that I couldn't share with anyone else.
Did you then leave ZBT?
Now, I never really left ZBT any more than any other member of my class did, because at that point in time, it was not atypical that your freshman year you were active in the fraternity, trying to get pledged. Once you got pledged, and then we'll kind of end, that was it. Your sophomore year, which was the year of, as I call, the year of great confusion, that was the year that I lived in the fraternity house. Then traditionally on campus at that time, juniors and seniors lived off campus or in housing, and they became less active in the house. They would go and have a meal and pretty much just kind of do their own thing. Or right about that time, that was probably the most stressful time in the life of WNL fraternities in modern times, because lots of fraternities were suffering from significant attrition, just because the nature of the beast was guys were going, hey, fraternities had become irrelevant in my life and I don't need them anymore. So I was no more or less active in ZBT than some guys were active in SAE or Phi Kappa Sigma or Pike or any other house.
Mm, that's a good point.
I didn't withdraw from ZBT.
Well, I hate to do this, but I'm going to take you back, Walter.
Okay.
You mentioned freshman camp and Rush.
Mm-hmm.
I'm very interested in 1970. I'm class of 1972 myself.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
So I understand a lot of what you're
mm-hmm.
saying. That was the crux of our lives.
Exactly.
But let's go back to 68.
Okay.
I mean, you were the first who stayed.
Mm-hmm.
What was that like? You were the first to go through Rush, right?
Linwood went through Rush as well, I believe.
He did.
I think Linwood went through Rush. I think Linwood didn't go through as extensive a rush as I kind of just signed up for everybody. I didn't care. I mean, my attitude was, hey, let's just go out there and meet some guys and drink some beer. Yeah, I mean, whoop-de-doo, it's a big old party. I mean, I'm just kind of a wide-eyed kid in the big city. Three blocks from home, but wide-eyed kid in the big city, of course. When we started, as I recall, we came on campus for, I don't know, maybe a day, a couple hours, or whatever it was, and then immediately got on school buses and went to Natural Bridge. And in Natural Bridge, you are assigned to cabins by alphabetical order. And I forget how many people were in each cabin, but I can't even remember, but I think we had two people to a bed, which most of us found pretty appalling. It's like, well, I'm not sleeping with this guy. You got to be crazy. But you go to freshman camp, and you spend a day or two or whatever in Natural Bridge, which is quite nice. Then you come back, and you begin the rush process. And, of course, this time you're going through your advanced placement testing and your registration and, you know, getting your classes squared away. And it's just this wide-eyed time when it's like, this stuff is whirling around you. And as I say, we came in as a very clean-cut, traditional Washington and Lee class. We had a dress code. You know, we had to wear a coat and tie to class. Most of us had relatively manageable hair in terms of length. We were all relatively clean-shaven, all mannerable people. Traditional Washington and Lee students of the 1960s, you know, mid and late 1960s, guys who, you know, liked to have a good time, you know, drank a little wine, a little beer, a little whiskey, whatever, chased a few women we could find them to chase, and that was us. And, you know, 17, 18 years old, whatever the guys were in the class, that's kind of who we were. We all showed up. I came back to campus and went through rush. As I recall, I don't know how many houses I visited, but a very high percentage of the houses that I visited initially invited me back for a second visit. As I recall, the process had a deal where you went in for an initial kind of a, you know, kind of a, this is who we are, and, you know, drink a beer and you talk to the guys, and either they hate your guts and you never see them again, and or they invite you back a second time, which means they kind of like you and there is some possibility, and then after that, that's when they really got serious about it. Well, I knew at the time that there were probably only two houses on campus that I'd really have any kind of a chance at all of getting into, one being ZBT, the other was Pi Epsilon Pi right across the street. But I went to ZBT and PEEP and Lambda Chi and Sigma Chi and Phi Gam and maybe Sigma Nu even. I think even went to Beta. I mean, I think the only ones I didn't go to were Phi Delta and SAE and maybe one or two others, because you could only do so many of the 18. But I did as many as you could do, and as I say, of the number that I could do, got invited back to a significant portion of those, and had a very good experience. A lot of that went back to the fact that having been, well, being what I'd call a townie, I had an unfair advantage, because a lot of these guys, it wasn't new. I mean, a lot of these guys I had known, and I attributed to the fact that I knew some of these guys from the time I was in high school and worked at the dining hall. And so I knew some of these guys when they were freshmen. And now they were juniors or seniors, and they remembered me, of course, and it was kind of like, oh, yeah, old home week. You know, I remembered you. We used to work together at the dining hall when they were, you know, on work study or whatever. So I think a lot of it clearly had to do with the fact that there was some prior knowledge and they felt comfortable with me and I felt comfortable with them. But whatever the number of houses was, I got invited back to a second time. I chose to go with ZBT. And ZBT, up until that time, had been almost exclusively Jewish. And I think my class probably was the class that had the first couple folk in it that were non-Jewish. Me and Tom Rogers and maybe one or two other people went into that class that were not Jewish. And just, you know, went into that situation, made very good friends with my fraternity brothers, very close to my fraternity brothers, and just had a traditional freshman year here.
You turn the tape
okay.
off.
Okay.